We're here with Mike Baker. Mike, welcome to my show. How to Be Tom Shalhoub, a podcast starring me, Tom Shalhoub. Each week, I explore a topic or speak with someone I find interesting, someone I think you could learn from. By listening, you might gain some insight into what it's like to be Tom Shalhoub. Now, why would anybody want to do that? Well, look, you have to model yourself after someone, right? Might as well be me. I mean, who are you going to be, Albert Einstein? Much easier to start with someone simple, like me, Tom Shalhoub.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, good to see you there. And
good to see you.
So this is Mike Baker of Portman Square, but it used to be Mike Baker of Diligence LLC. That's what we used to always talk about when you were on Red Eye. Can you tell me the difference between Portman Square and Diligence? It's probably they're both consulting firms, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah, it's actually the same company. My original partners and I were able to wrestle the business back from our last investor group. We kind of split it up amongst ourselves. I basically retired the Diligence name and rebranded it as Portman Square Group. So it's the same people. It's the same great staff, same great services, same, just better taste. That's all.
I see. Diligence sounds more like action figure, guy like... When I hear Diligence, I think of you, like that picture of you with the, with the semi-automatic standing outside the Jeep, But then Portman Square, I mean, it sounds a little more like, an advertising firm. I mean, have you mellowed out a little bit?
Doesn't it? Sounds a little more sophisticated. I know. It's a little more elegant. It's same great clients and all the rest. After all that time, I just thought, we'll go. And my wife, more backstory than you probably or anybody needs. My wife had started some years ago a crisis communications firm and a policy group. And back when she was coming up with names for it, I said, well, why don't we name it after the square that I basically used to live on in London, Portman Square? And so she went with that name. And then when I decided to retire Diligence name and come up with a new one, I looked around. I thought, I can't come up with a better name than Portman Square Group. So I said, how about we merge the two companies? First she said, what, are you insane? And I said, hey, I bring something to the table. So we did that. And it's been great ever since.
Yeah. So she's still doing crisis communication, but it's kind of a... combination with your company.
Right. It's very symbiotic services. Look, we do everything. We do investigations. We do intelligence gathering. We do security services. We do all these things. Crisis communications is a natural fit because oftentimes the companies, corporations, or whomever that we're working on behalf of, they're going to need some issues related to crisis comms and sometimes some policy work. So it's a really good fit. And I know they say you should never get into business with family but I haven't found that to be true because my wife is a hell of a lot smarter than I am. She's the smartest person I know. And so it's actually worked out great.
Yeah. Let me ask about the, like you said, the investors, I hear a lot about things like this, especially with like security firms and things like that, where they have, someone starts a firm and then, in comes either like do you call them venture capitalists or are they just, investment groups or whatever? But when you turn your company or when you go into business with a group of investors, I'm assuming it's a very complicated thing. What do they do? Do they go to your bank? They look through all your things? I mean, and then how do you get, you mentioned you extricated yourself from the relationship with these people. How do you do that? Does everybody sue each other?
It's quite the process. We've gone through two rounds of investment back in the old days. We're wholly owned by myself, my wife. At this point, Portman Square Group is a wholly owned company, and we're very happy with that. But when you bring in investors, it's, you know, it's like a dating relationship, only then it becomes a marriage, and it's there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of moving parts there. And so you have to really understand the people that you're getting into business with. They have to understand your business. They have to know, you know, exactly what they're taking on board. So if there's no transparency, or there's a lack of transparency, you know, it's a problem. You know, we've been fortunate over the years, and it's just that at this stage of my life, you know, I think it's nice to have, not to say we might not take investment down the road. Depends on, you know, how large we want the company to get. But right now it's pretty sweet, you know, being in complete control of your own destiny.
Yeah, I don't know much about that kind of thing or whatever, but it probably, my knowledge is based on, did you see Mad Men, the show Mad Men?
Sure, yeah. Yeah,
so they were small, and then they got bought by that British firm, and everything changed, and then they didn't have control over their own advertising company anymore, and then they ended up wrestling back control. So that's everything I'm hearing about you, that's what I'm basing it all on.
Yeah, it's, you know, that's not inaccurate. I mean, you spend a god-awful amount of time, you know, preparing presentations for the investors and, you know, shareholders. You think, okay, God, you know, do I have to do another investment, you know, presentation? You know, you feel like, because look, but that's the deal you make, right? You take on outside capital, and you've got responsibilities now for that outside capital. And so, you know, and that's the thing. If you're going to do that, you have to be aware of what that means and how that shifts the playing field, what your parameters are. So I don't know. I've been very fortunate. I would in no way bitch or moan about, you know, my challenges in life after leaving the agency. I've had a great ride, and I've been very fortunate in that ride. So I got no complaints.
So here's a question. You used to do Red Eye all the time. Okay. Yeah. And we would horse around, and it was very silly and sometimes inappropriate and ridiculous. And then you would come on as the ombudsman and you know, you'd fill in for Andy. I did that myself, you know, on occasion. You would guest host, you know, but when you were in the ombudsman position, you would engage in a lot of silliness. Okay. And
yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's true. But did you ever think like, oh, I can't do this. I can't be horsing around with these guys in this way, because it's going to reflect badly on my very, you know, reputable company. Did you ever feel like, oh, this is going to get me in trouble with clients?
Never once.
Never?
Never, never once. You know what? It's a great question though, because I know that there are, you know, there are guys that I know got out of the outfit or wherever they happen to be. They started a business, and you know, you have to take it seriously. Obviously, you know, I take it extremely seriously in terms of the work product and making sure clients are happy. But at the end of the day, you know, I am who I am, and I'm not going to, you know, change that. And I've been lucky in the sense of, you know, some of the clients, these larger corporations, they've been with us now, shit, for 18 years now, 19 years. And we're good friends at this point. That's been another real pleasure about this whole ride, is some of my best friends are now people we started working on behalf of that were clients. So I think quite the opposite. If I was, you know, if I had some stick up my ass and I was taking myself way too seriously, I think then they would say, what the hell's wrong with you? You got a problem. But I love that ombudsman thing. it was great, because you could just comment on what other people said and then half the time just make stuff up. And yeah.
Well, what about your wife? I mean, your wife, Crisis Communications, isn't that all about being careful about what you say? And did your wife ever say, like, you know, did she ever have any advice for you?
Yeah, her advice sometimes is to tell me to watch what I say and to shut up. But she knows. Look, I mean, that's the reason why I could never run for president. You know, there's too much stuff out there about me just saying, you know, saying shit on Red Eye. Probably most of the clips would be from Red Eye. Yeah. But
Rogan as well. You do Rogan all the time. Yeah, and, you know, I mean, he is seen as outside of the mainstream, right? I mean, he's not exactly, I would say, the most corporate friendly guy. So you've never run into anybody who said, oh, you know, that guy, he's a conspiracy theorist or anything like that?
No, you know, it's, Yeah, I get a lot of feedback from appearances on Joe's show. Great guy. Can't say enough good things about that guy. But I do get a lot of feedback. And what I've learned, I think, over the years, you know the same thing, right? You've been doing this longer than I have, is it, you know, you're gonna piss off somebody somewhere, right?
Yeah.
It's gonna be, whether you're talking about from a political perspective, you're gonna piss the left off, you're gonna piss the right off, somebody's gonna be upset. Right. And so after a while, Joe's greatest advice to me was just don't ever read social media. Just don't read it. Don't read people's comments. And he's right. You know, although to be fair, I read the positive stuff.
Yeah. Well, I see it and I do. I try to take that to heart. But I get the sense someone like Rogan, I feel like he doesn't even look at it because he's got a kind of a. You know, he manages his psyche very well, I think, in the way that he approaches, you know, his physical training. I think he approaches his mental training in the same way, because it's easy to become a jerk when you're a big media star like he is, and he's very influential in the world. I mean, he is he's somebody that, like, Fox News, we talk about him like 3 or 4 times a week. And
he's extremely well balanced. That's a good way to put it. He's got a really good sense of perspective. And I think he's got a great sense of humor. So that clearly helps. If you don't have that in life, you know, you're kind of screwed. So, you know, even when things are really down, you gotta dig around down there and find a piece of humor somewhere.
Yeah. So you mentioned England. You were, if I'm right, you're English. Like, you were born in England. Am I right?
Yeah. I'm still a dual citizen. I just got back from London. Great town. My boys, Scooter, Sluggo, and Muggsy, they've got their citizenship.
Yeah.
It's my dream. My dream is to move to a small village, you know, in the Cotswolds, in the countryside, and, you know, maybe just solve a murder once a year or so.
That would be one of my favorite shows, Shetland.
Yeah.
Shetland, a great detective show based on the Anne Cleve novels, and it takes place in the Shetland Islands. But that's what I would picture you off solving crimes on an island.
That's I just all I need is one a year just to keep me in beer yeah. money. You know, get enough feed for the sheep. But I took my wife and my boys. Last year, I guess maybe it was, or the year before, I rented a small cottage up in a beautiful little countryside village, Byberry, and I thought this will be great. They'll see what I'm talking about. They'll understand why I keep babbling on about this is what we're gonna do one day. And so we got up there to this small village, you know, and it's quiet except for the sheep, kind of, you know, in the background up in the hills. And after about 2 days, they were like, "Oh God, what the hell is this?" this is it. We're going to go for walks and then we're going to go to the pub. And I said, that's it. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I could do it. I like it. I have, you know, I'm working on I haven't gotten it yet, but I'm all my paperwork is in to get the Irish passport because my grandparents were both born in Ireland. So then I'll have the dual citizenship there. And then I guess I have essentially, that's EU, right? Ireland. So I can kind of go around Europe with the
absolutely.
Irish passport, right?
Yeah. It's anybody who's got the, not, you know, not for that. You know, people say, well, if they win that presidential election, I'm leaving the country.
Yeah.
And nobody ever does. But I mean, it's just good to have a backup. It's good to have a second passport. I think I've got 7 or 8 of them, so most of them not in my name, but anyway. I shouldn't have said that.
But would you recommend, this would be it's an idea in the back of my head, if I were traveling around the world, that I would have the Irish passport in my pocket, because I would think if some bad guys pick me up, whether they're, Russians, Middle Eastern terrorists or whatever, I'm going to want to have a non-U.S. passport, I think, right? I don't want the terrorists to think I'm U.S. Am I right about that?
No, look, that's absolutely true. I mean, if you think about it, You know, it's that's just a logical thing, right? You know, next thing you know, they're pulling passports off of passengers. You know, some plane gets jacked and they're looking. What are they looking for? They're looking for U.S. passports.
Yeah.
Again, not to over. But, you know, it's not atypical. So anyway, I think it's a great idea. Yeah. So and I wholeheartedly encourage it, even if you can't get a genuine one. Go out there, kids, and get yourself some fake passport.
Like Jason Bourne, you got a whole box.
You gotta have a box of them in a safe in a Swiss bank.
So the CIA, right? You're CIA. Yeah. You talk on Rogan about intelligence matters. On a recent Rogan, you said he was asking you about October 7th, and you said, massive intelligence failure. That was a quote. And I wrote that down because people have been saying that, massive intelligence failure. And then you said it. And I said, I got to ask Mike about that because I feel like we hear that phrase a lot in the past 20 years. I mean, are these guys any good? And I'm talking about your old colleagues, CIA, MI6, you got Mossad, you got, you know, obviously, or those the big three. Are they any good at what they do? Because it seems like, you know, Iraq was massive intelligence failure. Obviously, domestically, what has gone on with the Trump era with you know, Russia collusion, massive intelligence. I don't know if it's failure or if it's, you know, bad actors. Probably a little of both. And then you got this what's supposed to be the best guys, Mossad and Israeli intelligence, and there was a failure there. So, what is the reason for it? Is it just, are they all overrated?
No, they're not overrated. There's a general sense in the public's mind, I think, because they do watch Jason Bourne movies and they do watch, you know, spy films and TV shows and read spy books and everything. There's this sense that it's, you know, it's infallible, that you know, this is how you operate. You get the intelligence, you act, you stop the whatever the action is by the terrorists or whomever. And that's not the way it works. It's a human endeavor, right? And so, yes, I would stack up the agency, you know, MI6 and Mossad, you know, against any organization out there, right? I think we're those make up, as far as I'm concerned, maybe someone else has a different opinion, the top three. But they make mistakes. It is an enormously heavy lift when you're talking about gathering intelligence on a terrorist organization, or it's an enormously heavy lift when you're talking about gathering intelligence on the Iranian nuke weapons program, or whatever the case may be. These are not easy things, right? But people watch TV and they go, oh, look at that. They wrapped that up in 45 minutes. What the hell's wrong with the CIA? So I can't overstate it enough. It is a very difficult job. And fantastic career if any young people out there listening and are interested in, but it's very complicated. What happened with Israel? Look, that was a multi-year effort, right? In a lot of ways, by Hamas and by the Iranian regime, which is the puppet master for Hamas, right? So everything that Hamas does, the IRGC, Revolutionary Guard Corps, is from Iran, is front and center. So they worked with them for quite some time. Look, Hamas ran a disinformation campaign for quite some time, and they succeeded in getting a large portion of the Israeli government to believe that Hamas didn't want conflict, right? Mm-hmm. That they were moving in the direction because what happens, right? People want to believe that, right? So they allowed themselves to believe it, but it was a very significant disinformation campaign by Hamas to get them essentially to drop their guard, right? They spent a lot of time over all those months, and I would argue well over a year and a half, gathering intelligence inside Israel, right? Because the more that they were successful, the disinformation campaign, the more workers were allowed into Israel, the more. So there's a lot of layers to this thing. It's not simple enough just to say, it's an intelligence failure. They missed it, right? And they talked about, they had all this. They had this report. Well, you have a report. It's like not some chatter. We had some pieces of information, right? Now, were we screwed because we were too siloed? And I'm talking about in the U.S. prior to 9/11. Yes, we were. Federal law enforcement, the intel community, everything was siloed. And so those little bits and pieces of disparate information weren't getting stuck together so that you could see a big picture when you step back. Right? And so the same type of thing happened with Israel. And also they dumbed down their communications, right? They because they understand, you know, so there was no SIGINT necessarily.
What's that? Messages.
Well, signals intelligence. So they weren't picking up communications intercepts. And look, there was it was a need to know. They had relatively solid operational discipline, right, in terms of who was going to be aware of what with that 7 October brutality. So I look at it and I go, yeah, was it a failure? Of course it was a failure, right? Because it happened. But from an operational perspective, can I look at that and go, yeah, I can see how that all kind of came together, unfortunately, in that perfect storm. And again, our best example here in the home front would be what happened with 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I remember at the time, because it was one of those things, it's happening now with the Israelis where people say they were warned of this, you know, and they have some memo that they can point to. Mm-hmm. I remember that famous memo, Bin Laden determined to strike within the U.S., right? And then people pulled it out to say that George Bush knew the attack was coming, and they say, oh, look, he wanted this whole thing. But the thing is, at the time, as a TV watcher, I knew Bin Laden was determined to strike inside the U.S.
Yeah, we were jamming up Bin Laden back when he was in the Sudan, right? And we knew it was a problem. The problem was we didn't know the extent of the problem. And there wasn't necessarily a lot of, you know, will within the administration, U.S. administration at that time, all those years ago, to take action, which, you know, would have been a delightful outcome. But still, yeah, I would caution people because you're right. People always, and it's a natural human thing, right? After something like this happens, you want to blame somebody. Well, of course, you're going to have to blame some people. But, you know, do it after you have the facts and after you know what the hell's happened, right? Rather than just rush to judgment. And it's going to happen again, and we're going to have another. Of course, we're going to have another intelligence failure. You know, it's a human endeavor, right? So shit gets missed, and things happen. But after every incident like that, I mean, like our situation in the U.S. is much improved in terms of our sharing of intelligence, the understanding of how you work within all the various components that make up the intel and federal law enforcement, state law enforcement. So we've learned from that and have gotten better. But does that mean you get it down to a zero risk? That's never going to happen.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about this podcast, Presidential Daily Briefing. It's the PDB podcast. We all have heard that phrase. That's the thing that the president gets every day. The intelligence. Do they still do that? The president gets it every day they come in?
Yeah, it's the president's daily brief. It's put together primarily by the agency and, you know, combines other elements of intelligence that are out there that are deemed priority for that next day. And it's dropped on the president's desk. And, you know, presidents have different ways of going through it. You know, some want to read every word. Some, you know, want to skim it. Some want to be briefed on what's in it.
How long is it? It's
pages, right? You're not talking about a book. You're not talking about a lengthy document. You're talking about if you've got a topic, say we're talking about Ukraine-Russia conflict and there's an issue there within that that's critical for that morning briefing.
Yeah.
You could be talking about four paragraphs, five paragraphs. You know, it's not a lengthy piece because it's meant to highlight, which is what the podcast does. The whole idea of the PDB podcast, available on all your podcast platforms, is that we bring you the top three, four issues that should be on your radar screen for that morning. And then we do a shorter afternoon version every weekday. And you provide the facts, you put a little context in there, and Bob's your uncle.
And so, but you know, you're from the CIA. So are you saying your podcast is quite similar to the thing that the president gets every day?
No. I mean, I wouldn't imply that. Oh, look, it's one of our cats.
Yeah.
Look at that guy.
Fantastic.
Yeah, his name is Satan. Which tells you a little about his personality. But, so look at this. I look like Dr. Evil right now.
You do look like a super villain.
Yeah. So our PDB podcast. anyway, it's the form the same, whether we're covering the same issues Look, we don't have access to national security secrets. That's a good thing. Otherwise, we'd be in jail. Yeah. But it's the formatting is the same concept. We want to hit those topics that should be on your radar screen. We want to cover them with the facts, throw in a little bit of context, and then move on and let everybody get on with their busy days.
So you guys have editors and, like, you know, it's coming out with like a daily newspaper. You have to decide what's the story you want to focus on. Do the intelligence guys do the same thing with the real PDB that the White House gets? I would assume there are some, you know, there's slow news days and these guys got to come up with a presidential daily briefing every day. So, you know,
although I would say when you're the president, there's no such thing as a slow news day. I suppose there could be every now and then.
Yeah.
But they don't.
I mean, you know, they're repeating themselves all the time, right? So the PDB, right. It's all, you know, there's going to be something that they're talking about for weeks and months at a time, and they have to find a fresh way to say it almost every day, right?
Yeah, you tend to, because there's so much happening in the world, and because it's a short format, and because you're talking to the president and his national security team, you don't tend to dwell on the same issue week after week, right? You'll have a follow-up quickly if there's a resolution or it's still a critical issue and there's needs to be some recommendations made or some strategy taken. But if there's a slow news day, I think, you know, you cover, you know, what Kanye is doing or the Kardashians or something. I mean, you throw a little, no, you don't. It's just, it tends to be pretty tight, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah. So you got a media career as well. So you got the podcast going now, right?
Yes.
You got your firm. Do I call it a security firm?
It's an intelligence and security firm for all your intelligence and security needs. That's
right. And then you've got your media career, because every once in a while you pop up doing kind of an action show on, Nat Geo or, you know, something like that. Do you have any TV projects in the works or?
We do.
Secret or otherwise?
Yeah, we've got, we were getting ready to do a third season of a show called Black Files Declassified.
Yeah, I remember Black Files, yeah.
Yeah, it was a good fun. Oh, God, that show was great fun to do. You met terrific people. You traveled around, saw amazing things. Really enjoyed that gig. And then we were getting ready to punch up the third season, and that's when Discovery and Warner Brothers decided to make the world's worst business deal. And the next thing you know, they're firing people, including our advocates and our team. And in the world of television, not to be disappeared on a rabbit hole, but when you bring in new people, well, they want new gigs, right? They want new projects. They don't want to take on a legacy project.
Because,
you know, so it's just, it's an interesting world that they operate in. So anyway, we shelved that. But yes, is the answer. We're working on development of a new series. It should be a lot of fun. I can't talk about it much because there's some caveats on it, but it would be a lot of fun, and it would be kind of in the same vein, traveling around, a lot of investigative work, and focused on some very interesting things. But hopefully we can bring more news about that later on.
Yeah. So there's something that I've noticed lately, and I don't know how this kind of came to be, but there's various kind of like intelligence / world politics guys, and they like to like go hiking in the wilderness and then give you like intelligence updates while they're hiking in the mountains. Have you noticed this? Like, it's the, you know, obviously Peter Zeihan is a big guy, like Zeihan, you know, or
how the hell did I miss this trend?
Oh, I'm telling you, it's a trend. I think, I don't know if Zeihan was the guy who started it, but they kind of, this is the way it goes. They're like, they got their camera and they're like, hey, I'm hiking up Pike's Peak and I just want to tell you what's going on in the Middle East. It's like this, I don't know if it's something you've noticed. But
No, I didn't know that. Maybe they're trying to, capture the idea that they're Action Jackson or something.
I think it is. I mean, do you know this guy, Zeihan, Peter Zeihan?
I don't, but I'm going to look him up now. And
kind of a, I don't know what his background is, whether he came from intelligence or whatever, but he gives his opinion on world politics and, war and, you know, things like that. He's been on Rogan. And so I thought you might know him or have seen him in your travels, but it's hilarious because I'm sure it's just a, it's something he's kind of decided as part of his brand, but he's, I'm telling you, he's always hiking and like, he'll just stop for a water break and then he'll give you his update. And that's his podcast. And now other people are kind of copying his style. You know, they'll be skiing, you know, like cross country skiing. And then they stop and they take the goggles off and they're like, let me tell you what's happening in Sudan right now. You know,
I'm out here just shitting in the woods. Let me talk to you about the Gaza conflict. Yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't thought about putting that together with the PDB. Maybe we'll take it on the road.
Yeah. Well, you're going to see, now that I've mentioned that to you, you're going to see it more often. But you're out. You are in Boise, right? Or can I say that? Or are you still undisclosed? Boise location.
I'm still undisclosed. There goes the witness protection program.
Yeah.
We're in Boise, Idaho. Well, yeah. one of the greatest towns in the country. Fantastic.
It is place. Great. Yeah. I've been there. Speaking of hiking, I've been there and I've hiked in the mountains around Boise and performed there with Gaffigan. I haven't been there myself, but I think I got word that you went to see Jamie Lissau recently.
I just did. What the hell was it? Saturday night. He was at the Egyptian Theater. You probably know the Egyptian Theater.
I do know.
Great old spot right in the middle of town.
Yeah.
And so he came into town and did a great show. It was a lot of fun.
He did. And he sold some tickets, huh?
What's that?
He sold some tickets?
He sold some tickets. It was sold out.
It was sold out. That's great. See, that is the power of Gutfeld. I mean, Jamie, I don't want to say, you know, he came out of nowhere, but he was working around. He was professional. But since the Gutfeld thing, he's been filling rooms, and the same, you know, I could say the same for myself. I used to go out of town and I could scare up a crowd when I played the Funny Bone in St. Louis. But now I'll come into town on a one nighter and the club is packed. I played San Francisco 4:00 in the afternoon. I filled the club. And so my new thing, and I told Greg to start doing this, I'm doing 4:00 shows, 4 p.m.
That's crazy. And that you still get out in time to get the blue plate special.
Well, that's it. So it's I've noticed that because I appreciate it, because there's nothing I like as much as getting home by like 8:00, you know? And so, you know, I played with Gutfeld the other day. We were in Albany. We did a 4:00 show. I was home eating a leg of lamb by 8:00.
You know, that was really important to include that little detail there.
Yeah.
That's what makes a story is when you're that specific about something. So not just dinner, it's leg of lamb with mint sauce.
Yes, and I like that. And I've noticed that the Fox News crowd is the same way. They, you know, if I play Houston or San Francisco, these people, they don't like going in the city to begin with. So they don't want to be there after dark. They're all afraid of these urban environments anyway. Yeah. So they can come see my show and they can get home before sunset.
Yeah, I dig it. I think it makes perfect sense. It was a heavy Gutfeld crowd at Jamie's show.
Yep.
So you're absolutely right. Because that was a key part of it. And I ran into a bunch of people who wanted to talk about Red Eye and Gutfeld.
Now, before I let you go, and we're gonna plug the podcast once again before we leave, I wanted to ask about the rep of the CIA, like, you know, when I was a kid, the CIA, you know, it was the CIA. It was like, there was just, they had an ironclad reputation. But in the past few years with the Peter Strzok and he wasn't CIA, he was FBI as far as I know. But, you know, you got Brennan and Clapper and these other guys who were becoming very political. And now intelligence figures are almost all, you know, you start to see the retired intelligence officials in partisan camps. Has the reputation, has it hurt? I mean, has it hurt you? Like, does it hurt your heart to see that intelligence has become politicized in that way?
Yeah, it does. I think there's no doubt it's hurt the reputation. Hasn't hurt the operational abilities, right? And that's, by that I mean, it's kind of like with the Bureau, the same way. I know a number of agents from the FBI, and those guys just do their job, right? They're out on the street. The agency's the same way. People in operations group and the other directorates, they just get on with it, right? They don't care who's in the White House, right? That's not their job. And so you do your business regardless of who's sitting in the White House. Now, it has become more political. There's no doubt about it at the top level. And that's a very dangerous thing. You don't want a politicized intelligence organization, no matter where you live, right? And so I think part of the problem has been the willingness of some of these folks to come out after their time with the agency and engage in political activity, whether it's as a spokesperson on MSNBC or wherever it may be. That is a real problem, because that's how people sit and they look and they go, well, wait a minute, you used to be the deputy director at the agency, and now you're clearly partisan sitting here. What am I supposed to think, right, about the agency as an organization? If you were in charge and you're sitting there on one network or another espousing very partisan views, you know, naturally people are going to think, well, that must be the way the agency works. And I'm here to tell you, it doesn't. It's an apolitical organization at street level, or however you want to refer to it. But you don't want those senior individuals, I think, whether they're certainly when they're serving and even when they're not serving anymore, you don't want them to be politicized if possible. But, you know, that horse has left the barn.
And speaking of that, when I was first at Fox, I assumed you were a Fox News contributor. You never were a contributor. You've never really worked at any of these networks. And part of that is you want to keep yourself free to be able to do, you can do whatever you want, right?
Right. Yeah. To me, it kind of goes back to your original question about, you know, my business, right? My clients, right? I know I've got a whole range of clients out there, corporations, law firms, everything, and they sit all over the map, right? And in terms of their politics and the spectrum. So from a business perspective, I look at it and go, I'm a centrist, right? I kind of walk right down the middle, and there's not a lot of company there for me in the center anymore. But I think there's some good ideas, good sound practices on the right, for sure. I tend to be more of a centrist Republican than sort of a whatever you would call it, an independent. But you know, without compromise, and people always say, no, you can't compromise, you know, well, bullshit. You know, we end up with what we've got, which is, you know, people sitting in their trenches and throwing hand grenades at each other. So I've always felt like if I signed on with a particular network, then, you know, suddenly I'm boxed in, and I would have to be kind of going further and further down that path of whatever that network, you know, is what their view is. So that's a rambling way of answering that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think it's been more important to me to be able to kind of, you know, call bullshit when you see it.
Yeah. So we got Presidential Daily Briefing, the podcast. It's on all the things. It's on YouTube. That's where I first saw it. But, you know, they can subscribe everywhere. It's the Spotify, it's Apple Podcast, and it's kind of a top. Didn't you tell me it's like scoring in the very high?
Yeah, we hit number one on Spotify for a brief moment. And I said, well, that's not going to last long, because Joe is, you know, he's solid up there at the number one spot. But we actually took the number one spot for a brief shining moment in American podcast history. But we've been in the top five consistently since we launched it again in September. So it's been very rewarding. But it's on Apple and all the others. I appreciate you mentioning it. It's been a really excellent experience so far, and we're looking forward to doing some additional things besides the weekday morning and afternoon delivery. We've got some other ideas in the works for the podcast.
You got it's double podcast. It's twice a day.
Yeah, we do every weekday morning. I believe they say the podcast episode drops. I believe that's how the kids refer to it.
Yeah, it drops.
Yes, it drops at 6 a.m. every East Coast, every weekday morning. And then we do an afternoon version around about 4 o'clock to kind of catch up on, you know, what's been happening during the day. But that's a shorter version.
That's so it's serious.
Like 20 minutes in the morning, maybe 10 minutes in the afternoon. You know, and then you got this information, you can tuck it in your back pocket and amaze your friends at parties.
That is amazing. So what do you do with the, do you go in a booth or something at home?
Well, you know what? I do have a recording booth at home. But when I'm on the road and I travel a lot, in the hotel rooms, I really basically just build a pillow fort.
Yep.
And then I kind of do it. I know it sounds absurd, But I don't know how.
And what do you go? You go into the laptop mic, or do you have like an external mic? And
I've got an external mic. I got a little traveling kit, and so it's. But yeah, it's been great. But I do have a recording booth. We've got a fairly good music room. Two of my boys are serious drummers. We've got some other instruments. So we've got a room that's insulated, padded, where they put dad. And so that's where the sound booth is. So it works out pretty well.
Yeah. I just saw the blonde kitty. It came across. What's the name of that one?
Oh yeah. That is, that's Wilbur. He's another rescue. Will wander home with animals of one sort or another, you know, at any given moment. And
so you got Devil and Wilbur.
Yeah, Satan.
Satan, and, sorry.
and Wilbur. And then we got a couple of dogs, and I forget what else we got. I think we got a raccoon around here somewhere. Yeah, it's good. I think it's great. I think pets are very important for kids.
Well, we have a golden retriever.
Yeah, golden retrievers are great.
There we go. There's Wilbur.
Yeah,
fantastic. With the Christmas bells on. Well, Mike, thank you so much. Hopefully we will. I asked for you, I think, recently on the Fox News Saturday Night Show, but you weren't available. But you've done that before.
Just let me know. Keep asking, because I'm in and out of New York. So if the timing works, I'd love to do that, man. I love the show.
That's great. Well, I hope you have a great holiday season. A Merry Christmas.
Thank you very much. I believe we can still say Merry Christmas.
We can. Yes, the birth of our Lord. And I want everyone to download and listen to the PDB Presidential Daily Brief with Mike Baker. And Mike, thanks for being a part of my humble podcast. I don't think I'm going to drive that much traffic to your site, but hopefully you'll do Rogan soon and you'll really get some listeners from him. Have you done Rogan since the podcast started?
I have. And he's always been really generous about that sort of thing. We talked about it a little bit on there, and as you can imagine, that's a fairly significant bump at any given moment. I appreciate you mentioning it. It's really good. It's not, you know, I knew nothing about the podcast world until we started. So I give you a lot of credit. People probably look at it and go, well, that's not work. Well, it's work.
Yeah. I mean, even this dumb podcast is work, because you just have to, you have to set the time aside and do it. And then, you know, for me, it's not like I'm not the busiest guy in the world, but Fox News is constantly calling me in and out of the city. So, you know, but that's why I like doing this. This isn't really, you know, it's not the most professional thing in the world, but I like coming on. I like having chats. And this is kind of my own thing. It's separate from Fox. And so it's just fun to have a thing of my own, you know.
Well, come out to Boise. Do another show out here.
Yes, I will. Should I call the Egyptian? Good space.
It's a great space. I guarantee you'd sell it out. I think it's a 700 seat theater. It's an old movie theater, but it's one of those old, beautiful classic movie theaters. But it's a theater space. It's an event space, but I guarantee you'd sell it out.
It's great. Okay. I'll do it.
All right, man. Talk to you soon.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. See you later. That's Mike Baker, everybody.